listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Syrian facilities targeted by the strikes of the U.S. military and its allies a week ago were not used for storing chemical weapons, and samples taken from there confirmed this. That, according to the chief of Russia's General Staff's main operations directorate, Colonel General Sergei Rudskoy, who spoke at a news briefing in Moscow Wednesday.
The OPCW experts arrived to the place and inspected it. 2014. They stated that there was no activities conducted in relation to anything which has to do with the prohibited activities or agents. Then, the Homs province. This facility has never seen any chemical weapons, no researches, no storage, never. Then, Khimshishar
warehouse.
Also, this place has never seen any chemical agents, no manufacturing, no storage of any agents. In a country which produces and stores chemical weapons, these places are always protected and secured because these agents are dangerous to people. But these three facilities have never seen any security measures, just ordinary hangars, buildings. Right after the strikes, a lot of people been to these places, spectators, without any means of protection. None of them was poisoned or else. Also, in order to conduct investigation whether there was any possible contamination, Russian personnel arrived there to take the samples to see whether this place is contaminated. The samples, the analysis revealed complete lack of any chemical agent exposure, which again testifies that this institution has not been conducting any activities related to chemical agents for quite a long time. We don't see the reasoning behind the actions of France, US and UK. If they say that there were chemical agents on these places, then after a strike, a cruise missile strike, then all these areas would have been contaminated. And when it comes to Damascus, dozens of thousands of people would have been dead. As for the strike itself, the United States, France and the UK conducted the strikes and stated that the strikes were completely successful. They say that all missiles completed the mission. And the center near Damascus was targeted by over 70 cruise missiles, and the Himshishah storage facility was tracking with over 30 missiles. So the overall count of missiles used over 100. We analyzed the strike in every detail, gathering the wreckage and pieces of the missiles, analyzing the targets. We have conducted investigation, and we can say that we've seen not more than 22 explosions, places where missiles struck. As for Damascus, only 13 missiles hit the target, not 76, as they say. We see the debris of a building which used to be the institution, but the buildings around are completely intact. The Tomahawk cruise missile has the warhead of over 150 kilograms. It seems that if we take two Berdin BA-1B strategic bombers, over 7.5 tons of explosives should have been there. It means that the whole area would have been raised to the ground, but that's not the case, as you can see, judging by the photos. Objective control data shows, as well as witnesses reports, that the Panzer OSA, Strela 10, Buk, Quadrat, S-125, and other anti-missile air defense systems which guard the sky above Damascus and air bases, many other places, have destroyed over 70 cruise missiles. Judging by the trajectories and the Syrian capabilities for air defense, they've been destroyed in five locations, three to the west of Damascus, two to the east of it. Fragments of cruise missiles were found there. They include the holes and all the other evidence to maintain that these cruise missiles were intercepted. It includes serial numbers, manufacturers' names, and other information which helps to unambiguously identify the origin of these objects. This is one of them. After the briefing, you'll be able to analyze it in greater detail. Some missiles failed to hit the targets due to tactical failures, as we believe, this way posing a huge threat to the people and civil objects. Two of them, the JASSM-1 and Tomahawk, were delivered to Moscow. Their payload is also presented on one of the slides, right here. They are being analyzed and inspected by specialists. The results of this analysis will be used in order to enhance Russian defense capabilities. Now, the Himshishah facility, where, according to the U.S. version, according to the U.S. theory, chemical weapons were stored. The Pentagon say that over 20 missiles hit the target. We've seen only seven places where rockets hit, and you can see the satellite image to support our statements. As for a different place, they say 7 missiles hit the target, but we see only 2 so-called smart missiles, mostly damaged civil infrastructure, which has nothing to do with any military capabilities. In 3 interception areas, HOMS, for instance, air defense systems such as Buk, OSA, S-125 and Quadrat of the Syrian forces intercepted 20 missiles. You can see the fragments of these missiles both on the slides and right in front of me. Most of the high-precision smart missiles were intercepted by very old Russian air defense capabilities, which are more than 40 years of age, OSA, Quadrat, and others. They've been modernized with the help of Russian specialists. Ministry of Defense of Syria analyzed in detail the results of the strikes and the interception procedures. They already are introducing enhancements and changes to the air defense system in order to increase level of security and air defense protection of Syria. We'll also be deliberating over possible delivery of necessary air defense system to Syria, which will be conducted in due time. No cruise missiles happen to be within the range of Russian air defense forces stationed there. We're ready to repel any kind of air attack. 10 kilometers ago from the Khmeimim air defense, yesterday, 2 unmanned vehicles, aerial vehicles used by militants were intercepted. Nothing can stop the process of liberation in Syria. Ghouta is coming back to normal life in this suburb of Damascus. Authorities are now conducting the necessary procedures and everything which is needed to restore the normal life of people. There is electricity, stores and shops are open, and the prices on food has decreased by several fold. The southern end of Damascus, the Yarmouk area, is being liberated from the remnants of the militants. Together with the Syrian authorities, we've succeeded in an agreement with the illegal militant groups who control the eastern Kalamun area. They will be given opportunity to leave the region. Over the last 2 days, over 5,400 militants and their families were given an opportunity to leave the place and flee to rebel-held city in the northern part of Syria. The infrastructure is being restored. The militants dropped dozens of tanks, missiles, lots of light arms, which were previously seized from Syrian army. It is of the biggest interest to us how Western weapons happened to be there, such as anti-tank equipment, TOW, for instance, and others. Russian Reconciliation Center conducts the necessary procedures to let the refugees come back to their homes. Today, the eastern Ghouta has seen over 62,000 people coming back, returning to their homes. The Idlib de-escalation zone through a corridor near Abu Dhuhr and Deir Sultan settlements saw over 9,500 people return to their normal life. Thanks to the Reconciliation Center and local authorities, we have been restoring the infrastructure in Deir ez-Zor province. Starting from December last year, the eastern bank of the Euphrates River has seen over 44,000 people returning to their homes, finally. Russian Federation does everything possible to help Syria come to normal life again as soon as possible. Thank you for your attention.
That was Colonel General Sergei Rudskoy, the chief of the Main Operations Directorate of Russia's General Staff at the Russian Ministry of Defense, speaking at a press conference Wednesday. Meanwhile, in Brussels on Wednesday, the High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Federica Mogherini, joined the UN Special Envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura, and UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock at a joint press conference after representatives of more than 85 countries and organizations at the ministerial level gathered to discuss humanitarian support for those affected by the war in Syria. This was the High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs, Federica Mogherini. She was followed by the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief, Mark Lowcock, and the UN Special Envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura. Again, this was in Brussels at a press conference Wednesday.
It was very clear that the European Union and the United Nations together form sort of natural partners in all different fields, but on humanitarian work and on the Syrian crisis in a particular manner. So I'm very grateful and I'm happy about this partnership, and I would like to pay tribute also to the involvement of the Secretary General of the United Nations that opened our conference today via video message. At the international conference we gathered today at the ministerial level, we had representatives of over 85 countries and international organizations, international and Syrian civil society, and we built on last year's conference that we also hosted here in Brussels. 85 very different delegations, bringing together from the Prime Minister of Lebanon to the Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey to the Foreign Minister of Jordan and Iraq, just to mention the neighbors of Syria, bringing together foreign ministers of countries that normally don't spend much time together, like the Foreign Minister of Iran, of Saudi Arabia, of Qatar, just to mention a few, two representatives of Russia, the United States, China, Japan, and I would like to thank the foreign minister for his presence here, South Korea, all the member states of the European Union, but also international organizations that spent with us this day trying to identify common ground. And I would say that this is the first result of today, having this diversity around the table, respect, all delegations listening to each other and trying to identify some common ground. Obviously, differences didn't disappear over these few hours of talks, and we never expected that. But I believe that we can say we identified common ground on at least two or three issues. One is that there is no military solution to the war in Syria, and that there is a need that everybody recognized to relaunch the political process. In a moment like this, I believe that this common assessment is an important element, especially for the work that Staffan will have to continue. The second element on which I have not found any divergent view is the key role of the United Nations in leading this political process. And this is extremely important for us, the European Union, because we've always consistently identified in the United Nations and in Staffan de Mistura the only legitimate leadership to ensure that the political process is meaningful, is inclusive, represents all Syrians in intra-Syrian talks, and happens along the lines of the UN Security Council resolutions already adopted. And third element on which I have seen a consistent level of convergence is the need to support Syrians inside Syria, in the neighboring countries with humanitarian aid, financial support, but also to support hosting communities, in particular in the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, but also Iraq and Egypt. And obviously, to this regard, I'm sure that Mark will elaborate further. I would expect that the level of financial contribution, the pledges that we gathered today, can guarantee the international community to support Syrians in these difficult times. I announced at the beginning of the conference the level of pledges for the European Union is going to be continued and sustained at the same level as last year, not only for this year, but also for next year. I mentioned the numbers already this morning. If you want, I can elaborate more on that. And again, I'm sure that Undersecretary General will be more precise on the expected pledges that you can have today. Obviously, as you know, the conference will go on this afternoon, so more on that level will come during the rest of the day. But let me say one last point, not to repeat myself on messages I've already sent this morning, opening the conference. There was, I would believe, another last political element that all the delegations recognized and shared, and that is the role of the Syrian civil society. We listened to not only one, not only two, not three interventions, elaborated long interventions from representatives of civil society. By the way, let me underline two women and a man, bringing to us a very in-depth analysis of the situation, of the needs and of the hopes of Syrians. And we want, I think, collectively to pay tribute to the work that Syrians are doing both inside the country and outside of the country to help their fellow citizens, but also to try and build the basis for reconciliation and the rebuilding of the social fabric of the country once the war will be over. I'll stop here, and I think I will pass immediately the floor to Undersecretary General of the United Nations.
Well, Federica, firstly, thank you very much indeed. I want to start by saying that the United Nations greatly appreciates the collaboration partnership we have with the EU in organising this second Brussels conference. I want to thank you and your team personally for excellent arrangements over the last couple of days and for your generous hosting of us and your hospitality of us. Thank you very much indeed. My best guess, forecast, assessment, estimate is that by the end of the day, we will have heard pledges for 2018 of $4.4 billion. I want particularly to thank the EU, Germany and the United Kingdom, who've made exceptionally large pledges today. I want also to note that beyond 2018, we've had or are expecting during the course of the day pledges amounting to some $3.3 billion for 2019 and onwards. I want also to note that a number of important donors have not yet been in a position to confirm their financing for 2018 because of the status of their internal budgetary discussions. And that includes the United States, which has been providing something more than $1 billion a year in humanitarian assistance to Syria and the region over recent years. And it also includes the finalisation of the next phase of EU support for Turkey to help meet the costs of the Syrian refugees in Turkey. So I would say that what we've had today is a good start. Obviously, in an ideal world, as is always the case, we would have liked to have raised even more money and to have our appeal fully funded. But we've made a good start. We do have to be realistic that within the resources available to us, there will have to be some prioritisation and choices made. And we're trying to get a fuller picture from all of the financiers of the choices they've made below their headline pledges, including the balance they want between the countries hosting Syrian refugees on the one hand and on the other hand for work to relieve the suffering of those 13 million people inside Syria who still need humanitarian assistance. Within Syria, we will have to focus, and the right thing to do is to focus on the most vulnerable, those in the most acute need. We have to address needs based on the humanitarian principles of independence and impartiality and neutrality. And that's a point that I was keen to emphasize in my remarks at the beginning of the day's proceedings. We can't expect donors to provide the enormous resources we seek if we can't assure them that our help will reach those in greatest need. And that also means having enough UN and agency staff on the ground to assess needs and monitor implementation. It's also important that we continue to deliver results to the people of Syria through the finance we raise. On average, every month during the course of 2017, the UN and its partner organisations was able to reach 7.5 million people a month inside Syria with life-saving food and medical services and water and sanitation and education and other support. And one of my top messages to those financing us is that the money you provide us makes a difference to the lives of Syrians caught up in this horrible crisis. There's absolutely no question that without conferences of this sort and without the financing we secure, things would be a lot worse. Thank you.
Mr. De Mistura.
First of all, thank you, Federica. And on behalf of the Secretary General, you heard it this morning. It's been quite remarkable, this type of alliance or common working together between the EU, yourself, your commitment, and the work of the UN. Now, I won't add to what you said, you're right. We were not expecting today a breakthrough on the political side. We were not expecting that suddenly delegation would start looking at differently from the political side. But we did not have a confrontation. And they were all there in the room. So that's a good sign. Remember, 1 week ago, we were on the brink of a very serious crisis. It was the closest moment to what one could say a very tense Cold War rhetoric and even military activities taking place. Thank God it was avoided thanks to mature thinking and mature decisions. And the priority of the Secretary General, myself, who went around the whole region, and in the meeting which took place in Stockholm was lower the temperature, top priority. Syria cannot become the reason for getting that far, not only in a national or regional, but even global environment. So from that point of view, I think that was achieved, but that doesn't mean that the Security Council has suddenly decided to take away or make away or brush away their own differences. The problem we are facing is that the UN Secretariat can do that much and will continue pushing together with friends like you. But if the Security Council continues being divided and angrily divided, well, we have to realize that that is not good. Now, I took advantage of this opportunity because it was the first one before, after this week of very serious tensions, to go through and analyze what are the current avenues, mechanism for political process. One is called Astana. And I indicated that the Astana duty, the assignment given by themselves, three countries, to themselves, was to de-escalate. They have achieved that last year, and they've been doing quite a lot of progress. But lately, we have been seeing escalation, not de-escalation. And we have seen nothing happening on a very important file for a year, waiting for Astana to deliver, which is the issue about prisoners, of detainees, of missing people. So Astana is in the danger, in my modest opinion, and I'm not the only one, to become seeing its limits, unless they decide to work hard on de-escalation, again, and on detainees. So that's one. Then you have got Sochi. Sochi was a very useful and very important effort. And it did produce a very good proposal. But the problem is that there was no follow-up to it. We have been waiting for the outcome of Sochi to come to Geneva, but there's been no follow-up on it. So Sochi risks also to be considered having produced a stillborn, unless there is a proactivity in this famous constitutional commission. That leads me to Geneva. Well, all this doesn't help Geneva. That's why I'm waiting and holding the fort about new intra-Syrian talks, because in the current atmosphere, that would not be leading to a discussion, a genuine discussion between the government and the opposition. So where are we? Well, we are at a moment when, in fact, by acknowledging all this, there is a need of high diplomatic contacts between not only the three countries of Astana, who will be meeting again, but many other countries who do, are, and are stakeholders in what can be the future political solution. If they, thanks to the wake-up call that we all got, but they got too, about the danger we all ran last week, would then start talking to each other on a roadmap, and we have it, it's called 2254. And in that context, very simple, everyone is fighting Daesh, 1 point, everyone believes there is no military solution, let's prove it. How do you do that? Constitutional commission. And let's work on it, and let's have the government willing to engage on it, and the Syrian opposition to be realistically engaging on it. And then elections under UN supervision. The Iraqi foreign minister reminded us, and I was in charge of those elections, so I remember very well, when they started the first elections with UN supervision, it looked impossible. Well, Iraq is not Switzerland yet, but look what the difference. And he was reminding us about it. And last but not least, you need a safe and neutral environment. People should be involved in engaging in elections and the constitution and not risking to be kidnapped, arrested or killed. All that is possible and today even more urgent than before, since this wake-up call is producing, and I cannot elaborate further, a lot of diplomatic high-level discussions. We are ready in Geneva, and with your help, we can go further.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to World Apart. Cuba is one of those countries that has long been perceived and described in terms of ideological opposites. Known in the USSR and later Russia as the Freedom Island that shed the chains of capitalism, it has long been seen in the West as one big prison ruled with an iron fist. But when you've spent almost half a century documenting the lives of its people, as my guest today has done, you'll find that the reality is different from the idyllic or ideological cliches. What is Cuba really like? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by John Alpert, American journalist and documentary filmmaker. Mr. Alpert, it's good to see you in our studio. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Now, you're here in Russia to promote your documentary called Cuba and the Cameraman, which I think is a very straightforward and a very honest title, because you really show Cuba as you've experienced it over, what is it? 45 years.
I worked on that film.
And I think this is very unusual for a Western or American journalist, because most of them believe that you need to cover stories from the position of either neutral observance or often from a position of judgment rather than experience or immersion. Why did you break with that tradition?
I wanted American people to really experience what the Cuban Revolution was like. And It's complicated, and I don't think you can understand this in a 90-second news report. I don't think you can understand it in 20 90-second news reports. I spent 45 years following three families and Fidel Castro. When you watch the revolution and you watch these people age, and you learn a lot about Cuba.
And I think it is also very obvious in your film that this kind of emotional involvement that you develop with your characters also allowed you not only gain trust, but actually gain unprecedented access to some of them, including Fidel Castro. You go the extra mile to show him as a human being rather than, you know, a historical figure. The way you show him, is that really how you remembered him?
That's the way I remember him. Fidel trusted me. I don't know whether he considered me to be a friend. He took a risk allowing my camera into places that it had never been before, into his bedroom, into his kitchen, taking his shirt off for me.
He's not wearing the bulletproof vest.
It's a Fidel that nobody had ever seen. Even the Cubans had never seen a Fidel like this before.
But I've seen some reviews, especially in the American press, and they were very, very critical.
Those aren't the reviews that I saw. I saw there were about 3 weeks after these like really right-wing people who obviously, I don't think had even seen the film, decided they didn't like it. But up to that particular point, every single review was positive, positive, positive.
Well, but I think the accusation or the claim that some of the review writers made was that you were way too friendly and not critical enough with him. How did you feel about it?
I think that there's some very, very critical moments in this film. The special period in Cuba when the economy collapsed, when the Soviet Union fell, and they withdrew their support of Cuba. The negative impact on the Cuban economy was like an 85% contraction of their economy. No electricity, no transportation, food shortages, and because the people trusted me, the people who were suffering, I filmed things that the Cuban people never filmed and that nobody else has filmed. And so the reviews that I saw understood that. More gratifying was and I still get them today, the hundreds and hundreds of emails from all over the world, especially from Cubans.
Well, because I think you treated them really as a human being rather than, you know, a foreigner coming into their country and passing judgments about how flawed their system really is. And I think this is what many people experience with Western journalists, including in this country, when somebody comes to your house, to your country, as flawed as it may be, and tells you, you know, how flawed you really are.
I tried really hard to be honest, and the most gratification I get is when the Cubans say that when their children ask them, these are pro-Castro and anti-Castro, when their kids say, Mommy, Daddy, what was the revolution like? They're going to take my film out and show them my film.
Now, the Americans like to quote this famous saying by a British historian, Lord Acton, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I'm not sure you would put it in quite those terms, but I think being in power for so long as Fidel has been in power and being hunted for so long, because I think he survived more than or around 600 assassination attempts, that would change your personality. Have you noticed any character changes in him over time?
Well, I think I was the last journalist and the last American to be with Fidel before he died. And he was always very open and friendly with me. I think in terms of his relationship to the United States, he needed a strong defensive posture, because the aggression focused on him was really, really very severe. I think it hurt the revolution. I think that the revolution needed to be more flexible. It needed to be more flexible with the human rights. It needed to be more flexible economically. Fidel got, to some degree, pushed into an inflexible position that he didn't come out of.
Mm-hmm. You think it was a matter of personality aging, or was that because of the pressure that his country was subjected to?
I think it's both. I think it's very, very important to have a very, very strong feedback loop. Fidel, when he was young, was all over the island. He was playing baseball with everybody. You know, he certainly couldn't do that towards the end. But every country needs to be corrected. My country really needs to be corrected. You know, that's our work. That's the work of us reporters. some people say we're not patriotic. I would like to say that maybe that's quite a high form of patriotism when you point out the things that are wrong with your country because you want your country to be better.
Well, I agree with you, but I think it also depends on how you say it, because I think sometimes, and that's my personal issue with the American journalism and American or Western criticism in general, is that sometimes critical things are being said to put people or countries down rather than show them deficiencies in their systems. And I heard you say in some of the other interviews that you believe that Cuba was never really given a fair chance to run its social experiment to the fullest. Do you still believe that?
I sure would have liked to have seen that happen. You know, when the revolution began, free health care, free school, housing, guaranteed jobs, literacy campaigns that taught everybody how to read. We were fighting for these things in the United States at that time, and the fact that they were going on in Cuba was very, very exciting. But there was always such tremendous pressure economically, politically, and militarily against the regime. You know, it would have been, let the Cubans experiment so we don't have to try this. If it doesn't work, we can look down there and, oh, gosh, it didn't work in Cuba. Let's forget about having universal health care. But they never had the chance.
I think the problem with the communist systems in general is that while they're striving for bigger things, they tend to forget about the little comforts of life. And I think you put it well in one of your interviews when you said that it's good to have free education or free healthcare, but it's also nice to have a hot shower in the morning. If Cuba hadn't been pressured so much, if it hadn't been sanctioned so much, do you think they would have figured out how to provide both to their population?
You know, they had internal debates there about the economy and sort of individualism. I don't think they were resolved. I think it's one of the reasons why Che Guevara left the country, because he was in conflict with some of the other people that had more power internally. And the tragedies we'll never know.
Cuba is now in the process of having a peaceful transition of power, and the United States Department of State has already described it in pretty derogatory terms.
What did they say?
They said it wasn't free, it wasn't fair, it was dictatorial in nature. They also believe that this is not really a change of power after all, you know, just a change of a figurehead. But there is no way of knowing what I'm going to ask you at this point of time. I think there's not even a way of making it an educated guess, but I'm going to ask you still, how do you think the relationship between Trump's America and Cuba under this new president is going to develop over the next few years? How do you see it?
I would like to see it continue on the path to normalization that was started in the previous administration. I think that was healthy. Look at the blockade and the animosity for 50, almost 60 years. Did it change the regime in Cuba? No, it was a completely unsuccessful policy. If you got in your car to go see your babushka every day and you turn the key and the car doesn't go anyplace, would you get in that same car every day for 50 years? No, you'd go the metro. You'd take some other route to this. The United States had you talk about Cuba's inflexibility. We had a really inflexible policy too that was totally unsuccessful, caused a lot of suffering on the island.
But the United States can afford to be inflexible when it comes to a little neighbor 90 miles away.
Yes, the kowtowing to the retrogressive Miami community that is every day more and more a minority, unfortunately, that's back and forth again. The last administration realized that the majority of Cuban Americans wanted normalizations, and they normalized. And when you normalize, you can talk. And I want to tell you from my experience in Cuba, when the United States used sugar instead of a hammer, things changed in Cuba in the way that the United States wanted them. I can't go backwards fast enough in this chair to show you what's going on in Cuba now. It seems that in order to protect election prospects in Florida, there's a little bit of a game that's being played with the very, very, very reactionary Cubans who are disrespected more and more every day by the Cuban community.
I've seen some Western commentators compare this new president, Miguel Díaz Canel, to Mikhail Gorbachev. And I know that you visited the Soviet Union during its reformist years of glasnost and perestroika, which as inspiring as they may be now in hindsight, ultimately led to the collapse of not only the system, the Soviet system, but also the collapse of the country. Do you think that's likely a likely scenario for Cuba if the new president indeed pursues the reform agenda, or if he doesn't?
So that was a question that I was asking myself, and I was very, very curious because of the half a century that I spent in Cuba, because of my love for the Cuban people. I wanted to observe this firsthand, but I didn't want to observe it from the back of the pack. And so I had asked the Cuban government to allow me to come inside as they were making their deliberations, as they were passing the power, and to observe this basically like a fly on his shoulder. And they didn't answer me. I had the choice to be in Cuba or be here in Moscow for some very important things this past week, and I chose to come here to Moscow instead of going to Cuba.
Well, we are very happy to welcome you in this country, but for the time being, we have to take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with John Alpert, American journalist and documentary filmmaker. Mr. Alpert, just before the break, you were saying that you had a choice of either going to Cuba or coming to Moscow, and you chose Moscow. And I know that you have something under the table to show us.
I do have something. I have my props here. Can you see this?
Yeah, and I can see the name of legendary Russian hockey player Vyacheslav Fetisov on this jersey. Why do you have it with you?
Look at this.
And obviously we have your name here as well, but still.
So when I was growing up, I didn't want to be a journalist. I can tell you how I became a journalist, but it was completely accidental. My dream was to be a hockey player. But my reality was that I stunk and I wasn't good enough. And I was always very enthusiastic, but an untalented hockey player. But Slava's my friend. I'm working with Slava on a number of projects. One is the first and last hockey game ever on the North Pole. Can you skate?
Not really.
Well, you've got a year, because next year around this time, it basically, to call attention to the environmental crisis of the North Pole and also the sort of political tensions, the Arctic countries, the Vatican, and there's one more, I can't remember what it is, they're all getting together.
Well, I usually do political journalism, and I think right off the bat, I can say that this is a very unusual experience to have Russians and the Americans doing anything constructive, because from my experience, they only bicker. But it's good that you guys can do something in the current environment.
You know, I think so. And you've been to war. And I think that because of our shared experience and because I'm looking in your eyes, I can tell that when you go to war as a reporter, there's something that happens inside you, and it changes you as a person, and it compels you, more or less for the rest of your life, to look for other ways to resolve issues.
You visited a number of war zones, but I assume the one that you remember the most would be your coverage of the first Gulf War, for which you were actually fired from NBC. That was clearly, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were specifically fired because you filmed its civilian death toll inflicted by the Americans. That was clearly an act of censorship, but I think, from my experience at least, censorship in different countries relies on different patterns. Have you figured out how it works in the United States?
You know, it's affected me in different ways. I've had the misfortune of being blacklisted twice. I was blacklisted for public television, not for war coverage, but for a documentary about healthcare, because the documentary pointed the finger at the sort of greedy financial interests that were keeping Americans from getting the best healthcare. That was it for public television. But the sort of interesting thing about the United States is that sometimes a door opens and a door closes, and a door opened at NBC. And I was the only independent reporter to work for any of the commercial networks. I had total editorial control of my reports, which is, I have like more editorial control than anybody here at RT has. I think there were a number of circumstances. General Electric, which is a big, powerful country, a company that has a lot of military industrial interests, bought NBC. And from that moment, the gangplank was out for me.
But I think that I may be mistaken, but judging from your previous interviews, I think it was more specific. You went to Iraq, you filmed the footage that you were not supposed to film, you managed to smuggle it back into the United States in your socks. You brought it to the NBC executives, and what did they tell you?
That every time I go to the third world, I make trouble for them, and they're tired of it.
Did they actually look at the footage? What was the problem with your behavior, or with
the behavior? And in fact, the regular news staff was devastated by this, and they had all supported me. They had seen the footage, and were proud that somebody from their team had gotten this despite Saddam's attempts to censor me. You know, we had three babysitters. There were three pages of rules and regulations. We broke every single rule. They tried to kill me on the way out of the country. They put a gun to my head and spent 5 minutes trying to pull the trigger to kill me, and I got the stuff back. And everybody was proud of me.
And what was there? What was on the film?
What was on the film? I mean, basically, the smart bombs were not smart. This was what we were being told in the United States during the war, that this was the first bloodless war in history, the first scientific war in history. And let me tell you, when any country believes that they can make war and not hurt people, they become even more dangerous. And so it was crucial to show these reports to the American people.
Did you actually show it to the American people?
Not when they should have seen it during the war. One of the tragedies of the war, and it's studied in journalism classes. There were a number of hand-wringing retrospectives about the way in which the press had not fulfilled its duty to the country during the war, and they didn't.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that Americans like to use the examples of the first and second Iraqi campaigns as something that they regret. But I think many of those things have been repeated recently. For example, the United States military has just taken over the city of Raqqa, which ISIS used to claim as its capital. It was taken by a very, very heavy aerial bombardment. Practically no building is left standing in that city. There are independent reports of thousands of corpses rotting under the rubble. And there is still very, very little, if any, coverage on the American networks. Doesn't that suggest that the system that you encountered back then is still in operation these days?
I can't talk about that because I haven't been to Syria. I can't talk about those reports because I don't watch the news. When I spend my whole day doing what I'm doing, I don't know about you, I want to watch a hockey game on TV. I don't think I've watched an American newscast in 20 years. I didn't even watch my own reports because as soon as I finished one of my own reports, I was on an airplane going to the next war. So I can't comment about that. I thought that the way in which the press was treated during the second Gulf War, because I was embedded for 2 months in Baghdad, was respectful, was honest, and was transparent. And it was the 360-degree difference from the first Gulf War. First Gulf War, the press was treated like a bunch of dogs in the alley.
You've been to numerous war zones, but you decided against going to Syria or, for that matter, to Libya. Why is that? Why didn't you want to go there?
And I make a calculus before I decide to go someplace. I'm happy to take a risk. I'm happy to risk my, I can't say I'm happy, but I will risk my life if I think that the report that I make is going to change something. And that's a sort of sophisticated combinations of things. One, I have to be able to get to where I want to go. I have to be able to operate with some degree of freedom. People's minds have to be flexible enough so that if I come back and I say, listen, this is what I think the truth really is, that they'll listen to me, and I need an outlet. And I didn't have any of those conditions. When I stopped working for NBC, I began to do documentaries. And the sort of, let's get on the plane. The bell's ringing over in Syria. I'm going to be the first person to the front, the first person back. In those days, I could beat anyone in the world. I'm sure you're good, but I could beat you. But documentaries is different. And documentaries is a longer, slower, thoughtful process. And there are only so many places that you can show them. And we basically make one documentary every 2 years, every 3 years. In the case of Cuba, it took me 45 years. The conditions, and I felt bad, you know, because in order to take this risk, you have to believe that there's something about the way in which you see the world that is important for other people to know. Otherwise, it's insanity to go to these places, and you have to have that burn inside you. So the first couple of times wars happened without me, like you had to tie me to the mast, but I didn't have any place to show it.
You know, you weren't there, but there were a lot of coverage of both the Syrian and Libyan conflict, and it was very much split along the ideological lines, because I could see the reports of my Western colleagues, for example, from Libya. Uh-huh. I was with there on the same square, right, in the same building, working at the, you know, from the same desk, but they would show something totally, totally different. I mean, the reality that I wouldn't even recognize, and I'm sure they would say the same things about my reports. We are now in the age of propaganda wars, post-truth, post-fact. Do you think you could even adapt to this kind of working environment?
I did pretty good in Egypt. So I was in the square in Egypt for the revolution. It's a pretty good film. It played on HBO. We didn't win the Oscar, but we got on the shortlist for the Oscar awards. And so made a film from, I don't know if you appreciate like my type of way of doing things. It was a quintessential film in the way in which we do it. Very well received. So the opportunities still do exist. And, you know, it's also our responsibilities as reporters to try and be as honest as possible, to not have an agenda when there's lots of forces pulling us this way and pulling us that way.
It's not about having an agenda. I think, from what I see, at least, I think many Western reporters, they come to Cuba or they come to Syria with the preconceived notion of what that country is. And they do their reports from the balconies of the hotels.
We call them balcony buzzards.
Well, whatever. I mean, that means close, that things, the more it, things change, the more it, they stay the
yes,
same.
And so, you know, listen, the first report I ever did for NBC was the first time I'd ever been in a war zone. I was up in Lang Son, Vietnam. The Chinese were on the hills shooting at anything that moved. And I, like a moron, I'm walking down the street there with my Vietnamese buddies. And so you know what I did? Everybody else runs for cover. I grab the microphone and I do a stand-up, because that's all I'd ever seen a reporter
does. Well, that means you have true reporter's instinct.
And so I said, I'm telling them what was obvious. I'm here in Lang Son, that people are shooting at me, and my name is John Alpert, and I'm working for NBC News. I looked at that and I said, you know what? That's the last stand-up I'm ever. I never did another one. I was so ashamed of myself, because all I was doing was copycatting. You know, they all wear the same clothes. They wear the trench coats in the winter. They wear the safari suits. And they walk around with briefcases. I'm going, well, what the heck is in their briefcases? You know what it is? It's makeup. And they spend the whole day waiting for the sun to get into the right position. They got somebody standing there with the tray to reflect. And they're on the balcony.
Well, I think...
So shame on them. And hero awards to people who go do something different. And it's not just American reporters. I've seen... the Russian reporters, I've seen people like this all over the world,
well,
and I've seen good reporters from every single country who will get dirty and will try to understand what the people are doing.
Well, I agree with you definitely on that. I guess we have only a minute left, and I want to ask you perhaps a philosophical question, but still, I think much of the global tensions are still centered around those concepts of freedom, democracy, tyranny, development, human flourishing, and what always strikes me is how differently they are interpreted in different countries. What freedom means to an American is very different from what freedom means to a Cuban or to a Syrian or even to a Russian, for that matter. Do you think those differences are genuine? Do you think we will ever be able to arrive at the, you know, some common understanding of what freedom really is?
I think it's always good to have differences. But we can't let those differences separate us. And what we need to do is, even though we might look at the world differently, we need to walk through the world holding hands and talk to each other about our differences like we're doing here today.
Well, be you know, mindful of being branded as a Kremlin sympathizer, because I think in this day and age, even appearing on this network may get you in trouble.
Okay, but anybody who knows me knows that I've always been my own person, and people have respected me for that, and that's why they invite me to come back time and time again, and that's why this project about the first and last hockey game at the North Pole, which has been endorsed by the United Nations, that's the other...
I certainly...
Let's do it together, and I'll teach you how to skate. You won't learn how to skate well, but I'll teach you.
Well, I will definitely try my best, but in any case, I hope that we can discuss your next project, let's say in a year's time, in this very studio. Thank you for being here today. I invite our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.